I'm John Collins. This is Bible Project Podcast. And today, Tim Mackey and I get to talk with our friend and Hebrew Bible scholar, Dr. Carmen Imes. Carmen has been on the podcast before, talking about her book, Bearing God's Name, Why Sinai Still Matters. Because she's a good friend of ours, and because she has an emphasis on the scroll of Exodus in her studies, we thought how great would it be to sit down with her at the end of our journey through Exodus and debrief a bit about the things we've been talking about. It was wonderful to talk with Carmen, but it was also a little discombobulating, actually, because Carmen presents a few alternative interpretations to stories that we've been reading. Namely, the story in Exodus 19, where Israel comes to the base of Mount Sinai. God asks them to become ritually pure and prepare themselves to make a covenant with him. As Tim and I talked through that story, Tim made a compelling case for how Israel was meant to go up the mountain when the trumpets blast. And when they don't go up the mountain, they've failed a test. They failed to trust God. But Carmen is going to give us an alternative perspective on this story, in which Israel was never meant to go up the mountain, and they passed the test by fearing God and staying at the base of the mountain and sending Moses up instead as an intercessor. And so, as we listen along, as two Hebrew Bible scholars discuss a passage in the Bible and come to fundamentally two different perspectives on what it means, if you're like me, you might get a little flustered. But it's also good to remember that the Bible is meant to be read in community, and we're meant to challenge each other.
And isn't it a beautiful thing that we can sharpen each other and trade ideas? Like, isn't this what the rabbis did as they read scripture together? And well, it could be this, and it could be this. And somehow they were able to sit with more unresolved tensions than we are. We want to know, like, well, which is it?
So let's prepare ourselves to sit in some unresolved tension around Exodus 19, and whether Israel was meant to go up the mountain. Thanks for joining us. Here we go.
All right, Carmen Imes, thank you for joining us today in this conversation on Exodus.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Let's see. So it's been a couple of years ago that we actually interviewed you about the book of Exodus, even about the same section of the book of Exodus.
Yes.
And many people in our audience learned a lot from that, learned about your work, and really were excited about you. So we were excited to have you back on because John and I have been talking our way through Exodus, and we've stacked up some questions that we've been talking through and are excited to hear your perspective. Let's see. So maybe real quick, just as a quick bio, for those of you who haven't heard that interview in the archive, feel free. We encourage you to go do that. But real quick, tell us about yourself, Carmen, and also about recent updates in your family's life story.
Sure. So the three of us go way back. We went to Multnomah Bible College together back in the day. So that was our connection. And I'm a big fan of the Bible Project. I use the videos in all my classes. So I currently have students in Old Testament history and literature class who are watching, I think, 40 Bible Project videos and taking quizzes on them. So they watch them outside of class. You guys kept making so many videos. I used to show them in class, but then there were so many that, like, there was no time left for me to talk. And so now I've created an outside of the class dimension where they watch them and take quizzes on our learning management platform. And it's the consistently their favorite thing about the class is that they just love engaging visually with the text. So that's fun. I am associate professor of Old Testament at Biola University. So having just moved down here from Alberta, where I was teaching at Prairie College for 4 years. So I'm in the thick of it with lots and lots of undergrads and love what I get to do.
That's great. And let's see, last time we had you on, we invited you to talk about both your dissertation and your book, Bearing God's Name. So we'll talk about some of those themes from that book today. But you haven't left the orbit of the book of Exodus. You're still there in other projects you're working on. Maybe talk about some of those.
Yes, I will be here for a while. I'm working on the Exodus commentary for the Baker commentary on the Old Testament series. So it'll be somewhere around 750 pages by the time it's done. Wow. It's a big project. And I am just thrilled to get to do it because it's giving me the space to work through things on a detailed level, to ask all the questions I want to ask and to chase down all the rabbit trails. And I love it.
Well, wonderful. When I learned that you were working on that project, as John and I have been talking through Exodus, racking up our questions, we were like, let's call Carmen. let Carmen speak into some of these things. So yeah, we are going to hang out at Mount Sinai, as we did last time we had you on, but we're going to focus in on some specific things. But maybe real quick, for those of you who don't know about kind of your first series of projects on Exodus, you really zeroed in on both the moment of Israel making a covenant with God at Mount Sinai, and that what God calls them, like by as a title, but also what he calls them to be and do. So maybe kind of wrap that together. That's where we are. Let's, for this conversation, we're parked at the foot of Mount Sinai. So talk about those first paragraphs and moments of the story, how that connects to one of the Ten Commandments, and just talk about that.
Yes, great. As you mentioned, I wrote my dissertation and I wrote my master's thesis on 1 Peter 2, 9, and 10, which is an echo of Exodus 19. So I've really been in these chapters for 10 years now and just think they're fantastic. And I really believe that if we want to understand our identity and vocation as believers, we have to go back to Sinai because this is where it really is fleshed out. The people arrive at Sinai in Exodus chapter 19. They've crossed through the desert, and the first thing that happens is God speaks to them through Moses. And in Exodus 19, verse 3, he says, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." And that moment is so important in Israel's development as a nation because it's defining who they are and what they are designed to do. What is the vocation that God has for them? And that phrase, my favorite phrase there, is treasured possession, which is just one word in Hebrew, the word segala. And segala is not just a warm, fuzzy term that you might use if you really like somebody. It's a technical term used in treaty contexts to indicate a special treaty partner that has a representative role. And so God is appointing Israel to a special task of representing him among the nations. And that's before they get the law. It's, you know, the second half of Exodus is known for having lots of laws. Before we even get to that, God makes clear, this is who you are. You as a nation are holy. You're set apart for my service. You represent me among the nations.
Excellent. Okay. So let's talk about how that connects to this language of kingdom of priests. And then also about carrying the name, I think, because then that tees us up for what we would like to do with you, which is actually to kind of walk through the steps of this narrative of how God shows up on the mountain and then how they come up to the mountain and then are they supposed to go up it, but only Moses does. So there's things we'll talk about there. But all the way back here, just this is setting out the ideal picture, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah. So he calls them his treasured possession, kingdom of priests, and that's before he's given them any laws. But then he does give them laws, and those laws are the means by which they carry out the mission he's just given them to be the treasured possession, the segula, and the kingdom of priests. So why is kingdom of priests important? Well, it's very interesting that God would designate an entire nation as having some sort of priestly status. This would be totally unique in the ancient world, the idea that everyone in this nation is a priest or that together they function in priestly ways. And so in just a few chapters, we'll meet the people who are designated priests in Israel's tabernacle, Aaron and his sons, and we'll see that they become like a visual model of what the entire nation is supposed to be and do. And so the high priest in particular is interesting to watch because he's the best dressed Israelite. He has this elaborate costume that he wears, made with gold and jewels and fancy dyed fabrics and embroidered fabrics. And we're told in chapter 28, Exodus chapter 28 is where God gives Moses the instructions for how to make his garments. And we're told that he's supposed to bear the names of the sons of Israel over his heart. So he's got 12 gemstones on his chest. Each gemstone corresponds to one of the 12 tribes. As you know, there are actually 13 tribes. We don't count Levi in this because he himself is a Levite. So I presume the 12 stones are the 12 other tribes. But anyway, he is bearing their names. He represents them before Yahweh. And then he also wears some kind of golden medallion on his forehead. And that medallion is engraved in Hebrew with two words, Kadosh LaYahweh. And it's holy, belonging to Yahweh is the meaning of it. So it's setting him apart as somebody who's designated by Yahweh for this special task. So with that in mind, like we can then circle back to they're the kingdom of priests. If the high priest is representing them between, he stands between Yahweh and the rest of the nation as a representative, then they as a nation are in a sense standing between Yahweh and the rest of the nations, the rest of the world, and having that kind of mediatorial role. And presumably they have this, well, not presumably, God tells them they have this representative role. And so it's as if they are wearing God's name too. And so when we get to the Ten Commandments and God says, you shall not bear the name of Yahweh your God in vain, which is what it actually says in Hebrew, bear the name, nasa, using the same Hebrew word that's used to describe what the high priest is doing with names on his chest. He's nasaing the names, and they are supposed to bear the name of Yahweh. It seems clear to me that that command is not prohibiting them from saying God's name or from using it as a swear word or using it in oaths, although we have to think carefully about how we speak God's name. The command is much broader than that. It's telling them, you are my representatives. I've put my name on you, so represent me well.
John, I realized I didn't invite you to say hi at the very beginning.
Hi.
I'm sorry. We're just like dove right in.
I'm going to let you guys nerd out.
We just dove right in. So as John and I were talking about this, he had an interesting question that I wanted to hear your response to it. But John, it was about the way that the ideal of a kingdom of priests, and then there is a family of priests within the kingdom of priests. And are those two at odds with each other? You had a way of putting it that was a really helpful way of asking that question. Do you remember asking that question?
I don't know if I remember the exact question you're thinking of. Was that, what conversation was it from?
Well, it's the ideal. It begins with a nation of priests.
Yeah. Oh, and they become a nation with priests.
It's clear they later become a nation with priests.
Yeah.
And the question is that a lessening of an ideal?
Right.
Or is it possible to have a select priesthood and all of the nations and priests, and that's just a happy situation? Or are we meant to see some kind of idealism that all the people are priests?
So, Carmen, I'd love to hear your perspective on the priesthood of Israel. When I talk with Tim, when we talk about the priesthood, especially in our series on the priest, the royal priest, you make a pretty candid case that the priesthood is a concession. And that felt new to me, that it wasn't the ideal. And here at Sinai, Israel is called to be a kingdom of priests. So is the fact that not everyone in Israel is now a priest, is that a concession? Or is there actually something really beautiful and important about what the priesthood is doing within Israel? Or is it a little both? Like, how do you weave through that?
Well, let me first admit that I have not listened to all of your priesthood podcasts, so I don't know at what
point. It's really good.
Disagreeing. Of course it is. Of course it is. But you guys churn out content faster than I can keep up. Mm-hmm. So at the risk of disagreeing with Tim, which I would hate to do.
Oh, feel free.
I think it's interesting that God calls them a kingdom of priests. And then before the golden calf incident, he's already giving instructions for how to build a tabernacle and what the priests are supposed to wear. So I feel like in terms of literary design, it doesn't seem like it's a concession there. Like God's anticipating the need for it at least. And there's something really beautiful about the high priest and his elaborate garments that he wears mm-hmm. that I think then help the nation to see what it is they're supposed to be and do mm-hmm. on a broader scale.
Mm, got it. So yeah, you're saying there's a harmony between the nation itself envisioning itself as a priesthood and then looking to one tribe set apart as a priestly tribe, as it were, like a visual cue.
I think yeah. we could look ahead to the New Testament and see a similar dynamic, because we talk about the priesthood of all believers, and yet we do have people who are set apart for apostolic, pastoral ministry, like in leadership roles. We have elders. I yeah. think the yeah. fact that we all have priestly access does not get rid yeah. of the need for there to be specialists.
Wow, that's a good point. Actually, and even more to the point would be Jesus is our high priest, but not to the exclusion of his followers being the kingdom of priests, right? Those two work in sync together. I actually never really thought about that parallelism being parallel to Israel and its priests.
I probably thought about it because of my master's thesis, because mm-hmm. I was hanging out in 1 Peter where he calls them a kingdom of priests yeah. and kind of looking at that yeah. symmetry.
I think the conversation, John, that you're recalling, and actually it feeds into what we'll maybe get to if we get to the golden calf today, that Aaron is introduced into the Exodus story, as you know, as a concession to Moses's unwillingness to be God's mediator before Pharaoh. And so it's just interesting that Aaron is introduced into the story because of God's anger at Moses. And I've just always thought that seems really important, that that's when Aaron gets brought up.
Here, let me just throw out a thought with that, mm-hmm. because in chapter 4, when Moses is saying, no, I really, really don't want this job. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't sign up for this. I wonder if part of why God's angry is because he has already accounted for Moses' weakness as a speaker, and he has already provided a solution, and Moses is failing to trust him for it. Because he says in chapter 4, verse 14, then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you. And I think one way to read that is God already had this covered. And it's the reason God's angry is not that he needs to call Aaron. He had already called Aaron. But Moses is the one who's failing to trust that God's going to work this out and give him what he needs.
Wow. Okay. So what you're saying is that because he says Aaron is on his way, implied because I prompted him or something like that, to compensate for your fourth objection. But now with this fifth objection, you're just kind of ticking me off.
Yeah. I mean, you could take it as God's answering Moses' plea before he even prayed
yeah.
it,
yeah.
which wow. is how I initially read it. But then as I was looking at it again and thinking about really the area of disability, like thinking about reading Moses' disability, the Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Like, God knows Moses intimately and knows what sort of support he's going to need. The problem is that Moses doubts his own ability and needs to trust. So, so maybe Aaron was the plan all along.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. So let's tuck that away when we come back to the developments later. But when we're at Mount Sinai, I appreciate your perspective that to be a kingdom of priests is not at odds with having a priestly tribe with high priests, that those can all work in sync together. So let's move on to kind of the next step in this story then. So God announced, you read God's opening words to the Israelites through Moses. After that, God invites them to become covenant partners. So if you just listen to me, this is his invitation. Keep my covenant and you'll be my representatives. So then God tells Moses, all right, we're going to make this official. I'm going to come down on the mountain in storm and fire and cloud. And on the third day, you're going to hear the ram's horn. And now I'm into Exodus verse 19, 12, and 13. And verse 13 introduces a really interesting detail where God says, on the third day, when the ram's horn is sounding, let the people come And depending on what translation you read, you get a very different sense of what's happening. So the New Revised Standard Version says, let them come up onto the mountain, which is, I think, the most natural way of reading the Hebrew text there. But many of our other English translations say, let them come up to the mountain, not onto it, just to it. So John and I talked about this at length in the previous episode already, but maybe kind of tee us up. What do you see as the interpretive challenges in this story? Why these translation differences, and how have you sorted your way through this challenging story?
Yeah, well, it's challenging because the people say they don't want to go up the mountain. And so then God says, okay, you can't. And there seems to be a tension in scripture about whether it was a good idea or a bad idea for them to not want to go up the mountain. Mm-hmm. I remember first reading these texts in Bible college and thinking, what a missed opportunity. They could have gone up the mountain and they didn't. And now in Jesus, we can. And so let's lean into this. I think I've shifted on this. I think I have a different opinion now than I did when I first read it. And I'm basing this opinion on the work of Michael Kibbe, who is a professor of New Testament and academic dean at Great Northern University. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on this conundrum. He did his doctorate in New Testament. So he was looking at the way Hebrews 12 recapitulates or recaps this event. So tracing it from Exodus to Deuteronomy and then into Hebrews. And he says that this moment, verse 13, is a test. So you've done a test video. You've talked about how God sets up these tests. He believes that this is a test designed to demonstrate Israel's fear of God, and that the proper response to an invitation to come up on the mountain where God is to say, no, no, we can't approach a holy God, that was the right response. And that this would then sort of galvanize their commitment to obey Moses as a mediator. So when they see that Moses can approach God and that they shouldn't, that shows both their fear of God and their trust in Moses as the mediator. And he traces that from Exodus into Deuteronomy and then on into Hebrews to kind of show exegetically how it works.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So that's good. This is a different... You're at a different place than where I was taking John to, which is wonderful. And this is why reading the Bible in community is so important, because we can learn from each other. So let me say back to you what I'm hearing you say, as you summarize Michael Kibbe. Because what God does say to Moses right before all of this is, listen, I'm going to come in a thick cloud. This is Exodus 19, verse 9. Mm-hmm. So that the people can hear when I speak to you, and so they can trust in you permanently. So I'm guessing that's where Michael is really, he sees that as a preview that this, the goal of this is to set up Moses and the people's trust in Moses as a sole mediator. Is that right?
Yes. I can read you a little section here. This is from page 32 of his dissertation. So the chapter on Sinai and Exodus. He says, Israel has not consistently demonstrated proper fear of God in the events leading up to Sinai. So he's not confident of their ability to respond appropriately to his presence. So the test here is to see whether they will respond appropriately. He says, the human recipient's recognition of the divine presence and subsequent fear is a necessary precondition for moving forward in the story. So then he goes on, he surveys, there's seven different options for how to reconcile these, you know, how could God say this twice? Or is there a, are we translating it wrong? Or, you know, what's going on? He talks about Salehammer's approach to it, which I'm guessing you're familiar with, and shows why he doesn't think that works exegetically. But he concludes the contradiction between saying, don't come up the mountain, come up the mountain, is intentional and therefore necessary for the flow of the narrative. And it plays a crucial role in the fulfillment of God's broader purposes at the mountain, which, as I already said, were to show fear of God and to establish that mediation is necessary. And so when Moses intercedes for them, the narrative is showing that he's ready to move forward as the mediator God appointed him to be. And that's jumping ahead to chapter 32.
Yeah.
When he intercedes for the people in chapter 32, that's the test of Moses. And God's presenting him with a test. Hey, should I destroy these people and start over with you? So they both get a test. Israel gets a test here at the foot of the mountain, and they say, no, we fear God. And then Moses gets a test and in 32 with, hey, should I destroy these people and start over with you? And he says, no, I'm going to mediate. And so they both pass the test, and now we can go forward with the intended mediator.
Interesting. This is great. So I'm curious if you or Kibbe, so here were the other two things that compelled me in the direction of Sailhammer's interpretation. And that has to do with the narrative patterning of this story is massively patterned after Abraham's test on Mount Moriah and then Adam and Eve's test on the Eden Mount when God showed up in the wind of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And there, Adam and Eve hide themselves from God's presence. And that's viewed as a sad fear of the Lord. It was a fear that came too late. And whereas Abraham's decision to go up the mountain and even surrender the life of his seed, even though he knew that God said, the nations will be blessed through my seed. So how does that work? So same kind of seemingly contradiction.
It seems to contradict.
Yeah. But there, for Abraham, it's his fear of the Lord is demonstrated by going up the mountain, not by staying away. So what do you think about how those narratives interact with each other? Because it also becomes a question of how do we interpret later stories when they're echoing earlier stories?
Well, this is going to totally throw a wrench in the whole thing. I have in the margin of Kibbe's dissertation, how does Middleton's reading change this? Because Kibbe says on page 43 that Abraham passes the test. So he sees the same parallel that you do.
Yeah.
Abraham passes the test because he fears God enough to obey him when doing so makes no sense in light of previous revelation. Mm. Israel passes the test because they fear God so much that they cannot do what he's commanded. However, Richard Middleton just released a book last year called Abraham's Silence.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited to.
You must read it.
Oh,
it is
okay.
Absolutely mind-blowing.
Huh.
So he argues that Abraham failed the test, that the test was, would you intercede on behalf of your son? Like he reads the Abraham story in light of the Lament Psalms and the book of Job, where our questioning of God when he seems to be acting out of character is held up as a positive thing, that we should question God. And Abraham fails to do this. He just slavishly obeys in a case where there's a clear contradiction between promise and command. And so he shows exegetically, like he does careful work through the Abraham story in Genesis 22 to show why this is the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to be able to do it all off the top of my head, but his basic point is Abraham is treating God like a Canaanite deity that would require child sacrifice. He doesn't even question it. And what God wanted him to do was to intercede the way he interceded for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Mm-hmm.
When he intercedes for Sodom and Gomorrah, he gets down to, what if there's 10 righteous? But he doesn't go lower than that. And so Middleton thinks that here in Genesis 22, that God is asking Abraham to press in and find out that God would make a sacrifice just for one. Keep negotiating down or keep pressing in to know God better. So yes, Abraham shows faith, but his faith is misplaced. He shows that he actually doesn't know Yahweh as over and against other gods. So that throws a bit of a wrench in the parallel.
Okay, so that's interesting. I'll need to work through his argument. But when he, in Genesis 22, when God responds to Abraham and says, now I know that you fear God because you didn't withhold your only son.
Yep. And I know that you fear God.
Mm-hmm. So that
you don't seem to really know me. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't seem to really know me. So like God steps in to save Isaac because Abraham kind of failed to intercede for him. Like, okay, so you fear me. Okay, we're good. But I'm going to go ahead and save your son because otherwise the promise is in jeopardy.
So now we're two stories deep.
Yeah, right. We were supposed to be talking about Exodus here.
Well, but this raises an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
When you have these narrative patterns, what does it mean to read one story in light of an earlier story? And how much do you import of the message of an earlier story into a later story? Is it just replay or is it a contrast? Does it invert? Does it reverse? And these are interesting questions because the narrators obviously want us to make these kinds of connections. And so the question is, how does the narrator want us to see the people at the mountain in some kind of analogous relationship to Abraham? In analogy to Adam and Eve? And if so, what's the comparison and what's the contrast?
And there's this clear allusion, right, back to Genesis, because they're not even supposed to touch the mountain which echoes the language of not even touching the tree that Eve says. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. There's some clear verbal parallels.
So you're persuaded by Kibbe that the people deciding not to go up the mountain and to say, Moses, you go up for us, is a sign of positive. It does have an interesting parallel to when God tells Moses in the same spot at the burning bush, don't come any closer. And there, that's a sign of his faithfulness, is by honoring, you know, the divine fire.
So then the idea would be that that Moses goes up on their behalf as a mediator, and God gives him the blueprints for the tabernacle, which is going to help provide proper boundaries so that they can approach God appropriately.
I see. Got it. John, I'm curious, at this point, where you're watching two people who have dedicated a lot of time to understanding these, and all of a sudden there's more than one way to read these texts, what does that feel like for you in this moment? Maybe it's energizing for you, I don't know.
Actually, it's a little frustrating, but I think, well, I mean, I spend so much time with you, so I just get inside of your brain. And so I could get really comfortable and just being like, oh yeah, this is great. There's a nice coherent way to view all of this. So it's a little jarring to kind of go, oh, that's how you read that story. Or there is a compelling case to be made to read that story in that way. But I think that's just my initial reaction. And then also I can hear Tim's response being like, ooh, I want to engage. I want to kind of hear that argument and through. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna let Tim hear that argument through because I don't know if I have the brain space. But I think what is cool is for me to be able to engage with these ideas on the level of narrative patterning, and just having that perspective and tool set is nice. I will say I'm very empathetic to the reading that we've been having, so it's kind of hard for me to detach from it and try to completely understand how the test for Abraham would be second guess me. I mean, that's interesting.
It's like an invitation to wrestle with God. And Abraham doesn't take the bait. Yeah. Like he doesn't wrestle. Yeah.
It's what Moses does.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
On the golden calf story.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I'm thinking of the Jewish meditation literature video in the How to Read the Bible series and just how you guys have laid it out as like, this is complicated and there are all these resonances and it's going to take us a lifetime to sit with these and wrestle with them. You know, the complexity means we just can't wrap our minds around it and be done, like check it off the list. I just also want to say that I'm still in the early stages of actually writing my commentary. So I haven't worked in depth on that question. Yeah. Like I quickly turned to Mike Kibbe's dissertation to help me answer it because I knew he had sat with that question for a long time.
Yeah.
But I haven't worked my way all the way to that point of my commentary. Yeah. So I may listen to you, your explanation of it and be persuaded by that.
Yeah.
I have a thought. Can I jump in?
Yeah.
It seems like these two interpretations cash out in pretty different ways. And they're both really cool ways. One is where we took our video on the test, which is a test is an opportunity to trust God, even though it doesn't make sense. And we have this image at the end of the video where there's this flaming door. You're like, I'm not going to walk through that flaming door. But then an arm comes out, you know, to lead you through it. And you picture Moses going up the top of Sinai, and it looks like he's going into his death. I mean, that's what Israel sees. But through the flaming door into the space where God and him can be together. And so it's this picture of, can I trust God even though I have this sense of self-preservation that's telling me not to? Or I'm second-guessing God's wisdom based off of my own assessment of what I need. That's a cool thing to think about.
It is.
The other way to think about this that you're suggesting is the opportunity that we have as God's human partners to engage with him. And we see that with Abraham as he negotiates about Sodom and Gomorrah. We see it with Moses negotiating on behalf of Israel. And that's a cool thing to think about, that we actually are, we're invited to participate in actually, actively negotiating with God. And those are kind of two completely different, they almost feel opposed to each other in some way. Mm. Like, just trust God, even though it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's something beautiful there. I think there's something biblical there. Or here's an opportunity to engage with God and almost second guess God in a way, because he wants to actually engage with you as a partner.
I think the key that unites those two beautiful approaches is the character of God. We can trust God blindly because we trust his character. When something looks like it's not lined up with the character of the Yahweh we know, that's where we would be invited to wrestle. This is what you see, say, in Psalm 89, where the psalmist is saying, look at all these great promises you made to David to have a king on the throne. And then halfway through the psalm, it's this, where are you? You don't seem to be upholding David as king the way you said you were going to. So there's a disjunction between what God says or what he promises and what we're observing in life. And I think we can trust God that he's going to work out his purposes, but I think he invites us to engage in, with him like that.
When we get to the part of the narrative where Moses is on top of the mountain for 40 days with God, there's this sense of perhaps that should have been all of Israel up there with God in the Eden space. Or are you pretty comfortable kind of going, no, that's great. That's the ideal. Like, Israel up there would have been a mess, like in some way. And they needed a mediator. And that the ideal was the mediator goes up there.
I think they needed a mediator. I think it would have been a mess because they hadn't been made holy yet. And so they needed a mediator because they didn't have a tabernacle yet and they didn't have a priesthood. And so therefore, there was not an operational sacrificial system that would repair that relationship so that they could safely be in God's presence. So I actually think what resulted was even better than if they had gone up the mountain. God said, no, I'm going to come move down into your neighborhood. I'm coming down to where you are. But the tabernacle facilitated that move so that they could safely be in the presence of God.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, this raises the whole set of questions about, well, I already named it, how when earlier stories are patterned, when later stories are patterned after earlier ones. So for example, the establishment of the fire and the angels at the boundary of Eden, and you can't go back in. But the whole narrative is like, but I wish somebody could go back in. Like, we need somebody to go back in. And wouldn't that be great if it was everybody? And so then you start having these narrative patterns of people, characters facing these life and death decisions, or maybe life and death for the next generation, where they stand at that door, as it were, and whether or not they're going to trust and step towards what looks like death and then discover that it's actual real life. And that was the, what do you say, that's the force or the pressure that the Eden story was exerting on me all through Genesis, leading me up to be inclined to see that same dynamic here, namely that the ideal would be for all the people to be re-entered back to Eden. But what happens is the people stay distant. And I do think there's something to the macro design, how the moment where the people say, we don't want to go, or they say that they stand far away and push Moses up. And Moses says, this is a test. That's in chapter 20, verses 18 and following. That's at the literary center of all of 19 through 24. So there's something there that it's really highlighting that moment that they want to be distant and Moses is the one who goes up. The pressure of the earlier patterns is what led me to see that as another concession, as it were. And so it's good that we have one, because if we have one, God can work with that one on behalf of all of the others. But it does point still to a lost ideal.
But even that one ends up not being able to go into the tabernacle at the end of Exodus, right? Yes, like yes. In the literary design, this is what your Exodus video brings out so well. There's like this unfinished element. And I think that's setting us up for why we need Leviticus. We don't have a priesthood yet. We don't know the sacrifices yet. And that's going to be necessary if we're going to re-enter God's presence. Mm-hmm. I think it's the mercy of God, isn't it? That he drives Adam and Eve out of the garden because he doesn't want them to eat from the tree of life and live forever in that state, in that state of brokenness. Yeah. So the people aren't ready yet to approach the tree of life until that healing happens.
Mm. Yeah, I appreciate that. That's good. I need to think about these things more.
We need to make a cup of coffee and go for a walk.
The problem is I don't want to wait till I'm 98 to say anything about the Bible. And so there's nothing for it, though, to just say, this is my current understanding, and I might actually land at the same place, but with greater conviction, or I might adapt my views along the way, and likely both will happen many times over.
And isn't it a beautiful thing that we can sharpen each other and trade ideas? Like, isn't this what the rabbis did as they read scripture together? And well, it could be this and it could be this. And somehow they were able to sit with more unresolved tensions than we are. We want to know, like, well, which is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's seems right. like there's maybe more room for ambiguity there.
Yeah. Let's transition to a couple other questions that we had for you. The first one, I think I know, but I haven't heard you quite speak to it. So I was curious because you brought up the tabernacle, setting up the tabernacle as a place where the relationship can be healed. So the tabernacle is full of garden-like imagery in its description.
Mm-hmm.
People have interpreted that symbolism in different ways, however, over time. So, and that is going to lead to another question about the dress and the role of the high priest within that place. So maybe first, what do you make of the tabernacle garden imagery within the larger storyline of the Torah?
Yeah, I think it's unmistakable that there's all this garden imagery. I have an article about it where I sort of assembled all of the different
echoes. Oh, you do? It's published?
Echoes. Yeah, so it's in the Festschrift for John Walton, us, but not to us. Huh. And the article's titled The Lost World of the Exodus. So I kind of take Walton's style of Lost World books and I apply it to seeing Exodus as a creation story. And in so many ways, the book of Exodus is a creation story, the creation of the nation of Israel. Mm. And so I think that the tabernacle chapters echo the creation event because it's finally bringing them to the place where they can dwell in the presence of God as Adam and Eve dwelt in God's presence in the garden. So many things. God consecrates the seventh day of creation. He consecrates the tabernacle. There's cherubim guarding the way to the tree of life. There's cherubim in the inner sanctuary of the tabernacle. There's a tree of life in the garden. There's a tree-shaped candelabra in the sanctuary. There's gold and onyx in the Garden of Eden. There's gold and onyx on the high priest's garments and in the tabernacle. You know, the other furniture has gold. The creation days go from evening to morning, and evening and morning the first day, and evening and morning the second day. And the lamps in the tabernacle are lit from evening to morning. So many echoes between the two. There's all these sevens in both stories, right? We have 7 days of Genesis 1, but we have God issues the tabernacle instructions on Moses' seventh day on the mountain. So he waits 6 days and then he hears them on the seventh day. Mm. We hear that in chapter 24. Mm. The priest's ordination ceremony spans 7 days and then they're clothed with new garments, just like Adam and Eve are clothed in the garden. The ordination has 7 days of atonement on the altar and the 7-day ceremony is repeated for Aaron's successors. At the very end of the tabernacle instructions, the last thing we're told is that they should keep the Sabbath. So it's the instructions are happening on the seventh day, and we hear about the tabernacle, and then we get Sabbath last. And it's the Sabbath instructions are the seventh of speeches. So we're on the seventh day, and there's 7 speeches about the tabernacle, and the last one's about the Sabbath. I mean, it just seems like it's everywhere through this story. Like it's very Eden focused.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's a very compact list. Okay. So all of that being the case, what do we make of just kind of these three sections that the Exodus story lays out then? So Moses sees all of this. He's shown what you just described up on the mountain, and he sees a high priestly, you know, figure and description and what it all looks like. So that's what he sees. Then the next narrative after those seven speeches conclude is the guy who's supposed to be wearing those clothes. The camera shifts down to Aaron, who is not only not being somebody who's ready for that kind of role, but he's making an image of a golden calf. And then you get the image, but Moses is the one up on the mountain, and he's actually being the mediator, and he starts shining while he's up there mediating. And so you have this ideal priest, the guy who's supposed to fill the role, who's like not fit for the job. And then you have his younger brother, who's actually seems to be doing the thing of what his Aaron should be doing on a good day. So what do you make of that juxtaposition of roles and failed figures and but the wrong person doing the right thing? What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, Moses is clearly exalted. Like he clearly has an exalted role over Aaron. And we see this again and again in the priestly ordination ceremony in Leviticus. Moses does all the things and Aaron is passive. Moses washes him. Moses dresses him. Moses does the sacrifices. Moses puts the stuff in Aaron's hands. So it really, we see Moses as a strong actor. He's the prophet. He's the one authorized to lead. Aaron is an interesting figure, and I need to spend more time thinking about it, but he's a model for every Israelite, but he's almost like mute. Aaron doesn't say anything except the blessing, the priestly blessing that we see in Numbers 6. He doesn't even dress himself. I have an article about Aaron's garments, his high priestly garments, in which I talk about the clothes make the man. So Aaron actually has no special qualifications, you know, skill-wise. He just... when he puts these clothes on and these things are done to him, he is able to perform his role. And I wonder if part of what we're seeing in the golden calf story is that God is going to take a very ordinary, flawed human being, and that the ordination ceremony and the clothing is going to transform him so that he can be put in God's service the same way the whole nation is flawed as a kingdom of priests. And God takes them as they are and transforms them to be his representatives. Aaron's interesting because he's not autonomous. He has no authority outside his office. You know, in the book of Numbers, when there's that brush up between Aaron and Miriam and Moses, and they're complaining about Moses because, well, we're prophets too. Like, you know, what's so fascinating about that is Miriam gets leprosy or lepra, however we translate that. And Aaron is powerless to do anything about it. Yeah. And he has to come to Moses and say, will you pray for her? Yeah. Because priests actually don't cure skin diseases. They just let you know if they are cured. And so Moses' authority is so much greater. He's not just one of them with access to God. Like he has a different level of access than Aaron does. And it's consistent through his life.
Okay. So how does that... difference between the two brothers and the ideal role, how should that affect how we think about the role of the priesthood, not in the history of Israel, but how the biblical authors want us to view the role of the priesthood? It's a good thing that there is this mediator, but at the same time, the first character to ever fill the role, it's like the volume is turned up on his failure. And the same will happen with the only other main priest highlighted, which is Eli and his sons, and they're just as much a failure as Aaron. So there's something, I think, very significant about that, about the portrayal of this priesthood contrasted with Moses. What do you think those overall implications are for how we think about the Hebrew Bible's message about the Aaronic priesthood?
Yeah, it is a very, I feel like the stories are fascinating because they're showing us the priests at the same time issuing a strong warning against any kind of innovation or any kind of syncretism. So the priests are, they never become their own thing. They can't run the show. In fact, the very first story we have about priests after the priestly ordination in Leviticus 8 and 9 is the story of Nadab and Abihu. Like first day after this thing is up and running, we hear about Nadab and Abihu, who bring unauthorized fire into the tabernacle. They're innovating right away. They get too big for their britches. They're thinking, oh, I work here. Here's what I want to do. Here's what I feel like doing today. And it's very clear that like there is no tolerance for any kind of innovation. This is about strict adherence to protocol. So they don't have some kind of greater authority outside of the commands that God's given. And so it does turn our eyes to Moses as mediator. Maybe it turns our eyes to the role of the prophet in the Old Testament or the Tanakh as a whole. We shouldn't be relying on the priests who at every generation seem to be corrupt. We should be looking to the prophets who then critique the priesthood and call people back to accountability.
So yeah, you would say it's fitting into a larger theme in the Hebrew Bible that's not like anti-priesthood, but it is saying we need something more.
Chastened priesthood, maybe.
Chastened, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to think about these scriptures are read and highly valued, say, in the Second Temple period, where after the return from exile in Babylon, there are no other institutional authorities apart from the priests.
Yeah.
But this is their Bible.
And this, these are the stories they preserved and passed on, which is fascinating.
So fascinating. Yeah. It's sort of like, I mean, I'm trying to think of I never think of good parables on the spot, but you know, a group that are the ones running the show. And the main story that we have to tell about our people is all about how the people who have had our job throughout history were total failures.
Well, it kind of makes me wonder whether there is this like scribal class that's separate from the priests who are actually preserving and passing on the stories. Like I'm thinking of Qumran, who felt like the priesthood was corrupt and they were going to be even more pure. And they're the ones collecting and passing on stories. So I don't know enough about textual transmission to feel confident, but it seems to me like somebody wanted us to see the failures of the priests for real.
I guess you could say the same. There's a lot of failed prophets too. And Moses being both successful at certain moments, and then he has his failures.
Are there a lot of failed prophets? Like we have the Moses moment in Numbers 20.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you read the Elijah story. Currently, I am persuaded that he is a failed intercessor by his story on Mount Sinai. And let's see, what else? Yeah, then you have the weird prophet who gets deceived and eaten by a lion. That's my
Which is a
one.
Parable, the whole thing. I mean, not a parable in the sense that it didn't happen, but
it's a commentary.
I'm pretty persuaded by Peter Lighthart's reading of that story as like symbolizing the northern and southern kingdoms and their failure to follow the prophetic word.
Yeah, getting eaten by lions. So, and you know, kings, of course, are both exalted as the royal seed of David, but also failures. So maybe this is part and parcel of how the Hebrew Bible works, is to say we need these figures, but at the same time, we just keep producing ones that fail.
We need Yahweh to rescue us.
Yahweh
to come shepherd us himself, because all of our shepherds are bad.
I think it's just, for me, it's the priests stand out, because even the first priest is not, there are no good priests. There's just the description of the ideal.
Yeah.
But every human priest we meet ends up being a pretty miserable failure from the start of their stories. That is so fascinating to me.
Yeah. I mean, Aaron's a total pushover in Exodus 32. Everybody's pressuring him to make an idol. And he's like, well, okay, I guess I have to do this. Yeah. And then you can see him kind of trying to quickly rescue the moment by saying, hey, let's have a festival to Yahweh, as if that's going to somehow solve the problem. It is a very negative story.
Yeah. So maybe here, I'll make this a final question. And John, if you want to do any twists on it, feel free. And this is kind of going up and summarizing a theme from what we've been talking about. What is the significance of a story about the Sinai covenant, Israel and the law, that both the priest and the people fail in the very moment of its inception? And so thinking globally, because it's so, especially in depending on what Christian tradition you've been brought up in, you think, oh, the Old Testament, that is teaching people about the law. And now that Jesus has come, it's about grace and so on. So I know that you don't buy into any of that. And I've learned a lot from you about how to correct those things. But it just seems so significant that in the story about the inception of the introduction of the law to Israel, it's total failure from the start. What's the significance of that in the larger framework of the Hebrew Bible?
Yeah, good. I mean, I think anyone who's tried to do a Bible read through and they got to Exodus, the end of Exodus, and waded through 5 or 6 chapters of tabernacle instructions would be able to tell you it's kind of a letdown to, you know, you get some stories again in chapter 32 and 33, and then we're back into more tabernacle instructions. Like, we get all of the process of building the tabernacle takes as long to recount as the instructions. And it feels like, why is this in here twice? Mm. But I think in the literary design of Exodus, it's super important that the instructions came before the golden calf and that the implementation of those instructions came after it, because it, what it says to me is that Yahweh anticipated the need for forgiveness. He anticipated that these are sinful people and they're going to need a way to reconcile with me. And so before they even worshiped the golden calf, he was already designing a way to safely live in their neighborhood. And he was already putting into place what would need to happen so that they could be cleansed and the covenant would not be called off. This is one thing that persuades me with Mike Kibbe's thesis that when Moses is interceding in chapter 32, he's passing the test, that God was in fact giving him a test when he said, I will destroy you. That Moses passes the test by correctly discerning that he should mediate, not do away with these people. And so then when you have the building of the tabernacle, we get such detailed instructions, I think on purpose, to mirror the instructions that Moses was given to show, okay, we're actually following God's plan now, and this time it's going to work. So these two things are framing the golden calf, which is where we see a total apostasy. Mm. And I think maybe important to note that it's not like God just kind of snaps his fingers and says, oh, okay, I'm not going to punish you then for that terrible thing you did, right? Like, there's this moment of violence where the Levites run around killing the people who were involved in this terrible orgy, worship, whatever they're doing. There's a sense in which those who have participated in apostasy have to experience the consequences, but the rest of the community now has a path for cleansing. Mm-hmm. Like, the residual effects of that sin are not going to hamper the covenant going forward, because they have a tabernacle where those things can be dealt with, the sort of the sin of the community as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I think it illustrates both that God takes sin really seriously, but that he's very serious about forgiveness and about creating pathways for forgiveness for his people.
Hmm, those are great reflections. Yeah, I can't improve on those even. I think as we come to the conclusion of this conversation, that's good. Severe and strong commitment to justice on human evil, but just as equal, if not a greater, as James would say, a mercy triumphs over judgment, commitment to creating pathways of forgiveness.
Yeah.
That's maybe not what most people would get after a first reading of Exodus. But those are really great reflections. Thanks for sharing those.
Yeah, thanks for your great questions.
Well, thank you, Carmen, for being on the podcast again and engaging with us more in Exodus and sharpening Tim, some pushback. It's wonderful. I did say it's overwhelming. I think it's also good for those following along to realize that there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And not to just let us simplify things, but invite us into deeper engagement with these texts, which help us understand the character of God and our place in the story. I'm encouraged, though, that Jesus is our high priest and we can enter the throne room on the mountain. We could enter the fire on the mountain. So at least I know that to be true. And and that is not less intimidating, I suppose.
Yeah.
But encouraging.
Maybe more intimidating, right? Like, we're actually going to ascend the mountain. We're allowed to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The trumpet's blasting. Man. It's go time.
And we realize that we need to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. Don't carry the name in vain.
Right. Yeah.
Awesome. Yes. Thank you, Carmen. We wish you all the best. And I'm sure we will be talking again about the Bible at some point. So to be continued.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for all your work.
Okay. How's everyone doing? We did it. I'm sure you have no questions. Actually, speaking of questions, we are going to do a question and response for the Exodus scroll. It's going to be in a few weeks because we wanted to give enough time for questions to come in for these last few episodes. In the question and response, Tim and I are going to debrief this conversation. Tim's going to read the scholar that Carmen has cited, and we'll discuss his thoughts. But also, I want to talk with Tim about what to do when we find ourselves disagreeing fundamentally about the meaning of a biblical passage. So I look forward to that conversation in an upcoming Exodus Q&R. Next week, we're going to begin the scroll of Leviticus.
The Leviticus scroll begins first with that good danger kind of tension. But then chapters 1-7 of Leviticus are one long speech from God to Israel through Moses that are an invitation, a divine gift, telling the Israelites how they can approach the source of all life and beauty and power and goodness, even though they are frail and mortal and morally corrupt. But God wants them to come near. And so he gives them the gift of the Korban.
Today's episode was produced by Cooper Peltz, edited by Zach McKinley, and lead editor Dan Gummel. Lindsay Ponder did our show notes, and the annotated podcast for our app is done by Ashlyn Heiss and Hannah Wu. Bible Project is a nonprofit. We exist to experience the Bible as a unified story that leads to Jesus. Everything that we make is free because of the generous support of thousands of people just like you. So thank you for being a part of this with us.
Hi, this is Joma Del Maniego, and I'm from Manila, Philippines. I first heard about Bible Project on YouTube.
Hi, this is Deanne Phillips, and I'm from Shreveport, Louisiana. I first heard about the Bible Project years ago when it first started from a church where Tim used to teach.
My favorite thing about Bible Project is the classes online. It was very good, illuminating, and it is for free.
My favorite thing about it, the Bible Project is trustworthy.
We believe the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus.
We're a crowdfunded project by people like me.
Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, classes, and more at BibleProject.com.